Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Sarah McDilling, and I'm honoured to be here today with the amazing Justin Cronin.
Well, thank you for having me.
Justin, you have finished an epic trilogy, and it's taken a little while. I'm sure everyone's been asking you how it feels to be finished.
Yeah, that's true. It's a good question. I spent 10 years on the book. And books, I sort of think of it as one macro story, so I often just call it the book. But and I've been working on it to the exclusion of all other, you know, professional commitments for about 8 years. So it was a big bite out of, I guess you'd call it mid-career. You know, I was in my early 40s when I started it, and I finished it at 53. So it is a little strange not to be doing it anymore. And of course, there isn't a moment where you simply finish a book. You know, it's like, oh, I just hit the period, the end, like at the end of a movie or something. You really kind of, it's more like the gas slowly letting out of a balloon, because you finish it and then you finish it again, you finish it some more, and then you make top edits and copy edits and you do what your editor wants, or in my case, usually not. And, you know, it's sort of, there comes a point where there are no more imaginative decisions to be made and you feel sort of done, but it's dragged out over a period of time. So what happens is really sort of a slow, for me, is a sort of slow deflation. You know, eventually, you know, there's this part of your brain that kind of empties out. And what I've noticed in the instance, in all instances of finishing a book, is that for the period of time in which I'm writing the book, I'm really borrowing my emotional life from the emotional lives of the characters. So what I experience at the end is in some ways a kind of midways, sort of melancholy. I mean, it's a lot of people think it's like finishing your final exams and jetting off to Daytona Beach to do jelly shots and dance on the beach. And I assure you, that's not the case. That's not the case. I mean, it's actually quite deflating and melancholy. And then the only real solution for it, of course, is to eventually find something else to write. But don't ask me what I'm working on.
I wasn't going to ask you exactly that. Okay. I was going to say, I had heard you mention that there was, you know, perhaps some untold stories
that
you might return to one day.
Yeah, I'm going to take a break from this world and these people for a bit. I think it's a good idea for me. I think it's a good idea both professionally and personally to do that. I don't want what my agent says. You don't want to be just the guy who writes the passage. And I think that's true. I've got a lot of others. Stories I want to tell in however many years I have of writing left. But there are a certain number of stories off to the side, which have bearing on this, on the story that people are now familiar with, the three volumes, but which the novels didn't accommodate for one reason or another. And I've actually written about half of one of them, and I think at some point I'm going to do a volume of these pieces, maybe three or four of sort of novella-length pieces. I like the novella. I started as a novella writer, and not as by intention, but the first things I wrote and that got published in literary magazines and so on, those, they were all kind of that intermediate 19th century German length, which is, you know, it's kind of hard to know what to do with anymore. There's not like an audience or a venue really that publishes novellas. So I'll give you an example, is the story of the Colonel in the, you know, his history, his backstory. He remains a mythic figure throughout, right? I mean, we see him briefly in the first book, but otherwise the whole arc of his life is one that is shrouded in mystery. I made the decision to leave it that way. Among other things, there was no narrative logic that permitted me to tell it in the volume, but I know it. I know his story. So I feel like that's the kind of piece I'd like to write. And I don't want them to be just for fans. I want them to be totally solid, freestanding narratives.
Well, you, in essence, gave us a novella in the middle of City of Mirrors.
I did, yeah. A sort of long novella, the story of Fanning, right.
Which was my favorite part of that book.
I'm glad to hear it. I knew some readers would be down with it, and there would be some who wouldn't, because it's essentially a love triangle story with a large campus component, right?
It casts a real spell, because, I mean, you're in the middle of this story, and perhaps the second you realize you're about to get Fanning's backstory in first person, it's a bit jarring.
Right.
But
I like jarring people.
Yeah.
I did it constantly. You know, I like to just ram it into a new gear.
Yeah.
And You know, I figured people who are reading the third volume had adjusted to this fact about my books and were along for the ride and would knew that it would have bearing. You know, they didn't say I don't know if this is going to matter. They would know that it mattered.
You always
in some
know
manner.
It's going to matter.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the reading the book is very much like hovering over, and we'll talk about the book as in the trilogy, like
right.
you said.
Yeah.
So reading this whole trilogy is like hovering over this grand mythic story and then just dipping into these small lives the whole way through.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, in a way, every time you go into one of these characters, like Danny Chase and Kittredge in The 12, and, you know, every time you do it, it's a little snapshot and a little, almost like a little novella.
Right.
The whole thing could almost be a big story with a whole little series of small stories.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that all big stories are made up of smaller stories. I mean, they're kinds of big... Yeah, this is the trilogy is really about the foundation or the formation of a religion, right? Something that eventually becomes a myth with a sort of that gives a whole world a sort of cultural history and cultural pedigree the way that religions do, right? Mm. And the way that certain myths do, for instance, like the myth of King Arthur is basic to the British monarchy, right?
Yeah.
It's sort of, yeah, right. It's one of those foundational stories that we all know is sort of magical, right? But that is based on something real. You know, I mean, I think that these stories always come from as I say, a human reality down in the dirt, you know?
Yeah.
And what you're seeing in the Passage trilogy is the human story that over centuries becomes something vastly important, you know, to the world. And but it is a story of people with jobs, friendships, marriages, children, you know. I mean, even if the world ends, you know, if you're one of the survivors, you're still going to do all the stuff that you and I do now, right?
Yeah.
You got to get up in the morning and perform some useful act, you know, a job, a podcast, you know, and you're going to fall in love, and you're probably going to have children as a consequence of that, and you're going to care about them more than you care about yourself,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that you have children will connect you to a future, even if that future is more in doubt because of, you know, the world that you live in, but nevertheless, all these things will happen, right?
Yeah.
Just human stories, just people, right? And, but then seen from a distance of centuries or, you know, 36,000 feet, there's, you know, it becomes something else.
Yeah.
It becomes something else. You can get a whole vision where you lose the detail. What I want to do is have the readers experience the detail and then see how later it's lost its detail, but you know it, right? The reader's in a really privileged position.
Yeah.
Right? Which is pleasurable as a reader, to be the smartest person in the room.
Right? You touched briefly on what's happening in the world around us.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I found interesting is, I think I heard you mention once in another podcast, the sort of golden age of post-apocalyptic fiction during the Cold War.
Sure.
And then how maybe there was a lull where people weren't writing it so much, and then it came back.
Well, the world suddenly seemed vastly safer in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
The Cold War ended, you know, basically in a weekend, it felt like it, and thus ended the single most dangerous period in the history of the human race. Right? The most dangerous weeks being the weeks of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Right? I grew up, I was born in 1962, I'm the last boomer year. They obviously, uh-huh. 62 is the last year for the baby boom. Which makes sense to me. If you want to know what my childhood was like, go watch Mad Men. I'm Bob, the boy, was named Bobby, right? I'm Bob. Like, I grew up in that house. Those are my parents. It's the same suburb I grew up in. All of that, right? And that period of history, the one in which I grew up, was one of tremendous danger, where everybody had in the back of their mind the idea that the world could end in somewhere between 20 and 40 minutes if somebody made a huge mistake. 10,000 nuclear. U.S. nuclear weapons pointed at 10,000 Soviet nuclear weapons. And then in 1989, it just kind of ended, right? Poof, right? The Berlin Wall went down. All the Eastern European countries, left the Soviet Union with, you know, they stepped out from underneath that umbrella without a shot being fired. The communist regime in Russia proper was disbanded. I mean, it was remarkable. It was completely startling, and people of my generation experienced that with profound wonderment. It's like something we never thought would happen. We thought we would live our whole lives under this shadow that might someday not just be a shadow. Right. So 1989, we got this big reprieve, And we got 12 years of feeling tremendously safe, like the world wasn't going to end. And then on September 11th, 2001, all that anxiety came back when the planes crashed into the towers. Now, I will say that since, as horrifying as 9/11 was, the world is still vastly safer than it was before. You know, people are worried about terrorism, they're worried about pathogens, they're worried about that, you know, social migration, you know, large populations out of a decentralized and Middle East. And so there's lots of things people are worried about. They pale in comparison to the anxieties of the Cold War, where I said, well, like I said, for, you know, in 40 minutes, you know, it could be just like a bad mistake, you know. But of course, that brought back all the anxiety. Was really not gone. It was just waiting at the curb like a cab with a meter running, and it all came rushing back. The good thing about the Cold War, if there was a good thing about it, if that's possible, was that we knew what to be afraid of. Right? There was just one thing. It was an overwhelming danger, and you could. You know, there were lesser things in the world to be concerned by, but that was an overwhelming fact. And then since 9/11, of course, we're just as anxious, but we don't know exactly what to be afraid of now, because our anxieties come from a world that has simply become vastly more porous, right? Mm-hmm. Where capital, labor, pathogens, goods and services, political movements, and so on can move across national boundaries very easily. Right. You can see Brexit, for instance, as a response to the anxieties over porousness, the porousness of our boundaries. And so what you see now is an awful lot of, you know, kind of end of the world narrative, but it's not really, there's not like one overwhelming source of the story. The novels that I grew up with, for the most part, grew out of Cold War anxieties over nuclear annihilation. Mm-hmm. The greatest of all, in some ways, being on the beach. Right, an Australian novel. Although the guy was British, wrote it. He's a British engineer.
So glad you mentioned that. Yeah. Often cited as influences for The Passage is Lonesome Dove.
Yes.
And then...
A Western.
Yeah, a Western.
Right, yeah, I learned a lot about how to write The Passage from reading a big Western.
Yeah. Well, the book really does defy any kind of genre classification. Right.
I know, as I hoped it would. I mean, I was working with a million genres simultaneously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the second book, you often say the inspiration was 1984.
On which I wrote my college thesis.
Yeah. And I've heard you say that there was no real one book that inspired you for The City of Mirrors, but you mentioned On the Beach, and
right.
I just found myself seeing little references to it, like mm-hmm. in the... I'm not going to try and pronounce the name of the ship.
But, the Bergensfjord.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is too spoilery,
yeah.
but what happened on that ship right. sort of made me start thinking about On the Beach.
Yes, and that's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Bergensfjord is actually the name of an event. There have been several Bergensfjords. The current Bergensfjord is a large ferry in Scandinavia. But there were several prior to that. One was a sort of semi-luxury cruise liner of the Norwegian line in the 60s and 70s, and I have lots of memorabilia from that ship. I have ashtrays and shot glasses and wow. deck plans and menus. And but the Bergensfjord before that was an emigrant ship that is sometimes thought, and this is sort of apocryphal, and I don't think it's necessarily absolute truth, but is often thought to be the vessel that brought the Spanish influenza to the United States in the autumn of 1918. The influenza virus, as I understand it, originated actually in the United States, in Kansas. Those were the first documented cases Fort Riley, Kansas, where a bunch of soldiers got sick, U.S. military, part of the expeditionary forces that then went to Europe. That's where the disease broke out in great abundance, traveled everywhere around the world, killed somewhere between 50 and 100 million people, came back to the United States. Some say on the Bergensfjord, which first went to, I believe, Halifax, and then docked in New York, and a lot of people on the boat were sick. And within like a month, it was in every state of the Union in the United States. And that's the kind of Easter egg stuff that I lay in to this story.
Well, and speaking of Easter eggs, connected with the, and I'm going to try and say it again, Bergensfjord.
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 Yeah.
there is a little callback right near the end to that. And, you know, you don't have to confirm or deny, but would one of the stories you revisit one day be...
the story of that thing that is found? Yes. No. Absolutely. There's an elaborate story there. I've actually thought about doing that as its own novel. Because, you know, I know what it was and what happened and the characters on board. And, of course, early in the passage, there's a letter that is found on a body on the ship, right?
Mm.
And it is, you know, Michael who finds it is, you know, wondering, like, what happened? And the answer is another book, right? I have to have the energy for that. You know, I got to kind of work up to that. I've had a shape for that story for a very long time in my head. And it's going to be a different kind of book in a sense that it's going to be a book, the story that takes place during the time of the great viral catastrophe. But in which the virus is essentially never mentioned, right? A bunch of people on a boat during that period have agreed not to talk about it, right? They've agreed. They're marooned essentially at sea, and they've decided, we're just not going to discuss this. Everybody we know is dead or dying.
I'm so glad that you're telling me this.
Yeah.
It's when you say that there's never really a point where the book finishes, and I feel that as a reader. It's the kind of book that... when you have finished it, you find yourself thinking about those little trails and what could have happened, and sort of keeps playing over in your mind. The story of how you came to the first genesis of this book has kind of reached mythic proportions now.
There is a human reality in the dirt for that too. Yeah,
like the story's been told so many times about you and your daughter and how this book came to be. And I don't know, I just wondered... Previous to that, you'd written very different kinds of books.
Right.
Was there ever a moment, you know, did it just feel totally natural to go in this direction, or was there...
Yeah, it did. It felt like... I undertook it, with just a kind of spirit of openness. I thought it would be fun. Let's find out what it's like. I very quickly discovered that it tapped into a sort of deep vein of pleasure in my brain, because I grew up with these stories, and they were, you know, reading narratives of the end of the world was immensely important to me as a kid, because not as cautionary tales, right? I was a kid, you know, like for me they were reassuring in some way, which is I think why we read those stories, apart from dramatic interest. I mean, these create dramatic circumstances for characters, but when you read a story about the end of the world, or watch a television show about the end of the world, or watch a movie about the end of the world, inevitably these stories are stories of survivors, right? And thematically they address, you know, the need for the best human qualities in the aftermath of that to surface in order that, you know, to demonstrate there is something worth saving.
Yeah, that we do deserve to keep going.
Right. Yeah, and in that sense, they are reassuring. I mean, as a reader, you experience the story as a witness because you're reading it, right? Automatically, it means you survived, right? You're one of the resourceful people. You're not a zombie. You're part of Rick's crew, right?
And
pick your story. And then, so you get that level of reassurance, and then you close the book or turn off the TV or whatever, and you look up and the world's still there. So you get a sort of two-tiered, double reassurance.
Yeah.
The only novel that is an exception to this that I'm aware of is that book, On the Beach, which ends in utter despair, right?
Do
Australians read that novel? Or is it just too awful for y'all?
I read it. Actually, because of having read your book, that's how I came to read it. So I didn't. I think there are more. Neville Shute has other books that you read more.
He had a very long list of books. I mean, he was a very prolific writer. I've never read any of his other novels. None of the other ones, sort of, reached American consciousness. On the Beach was, as far as I'm aware, On the Beach was the one.
With the show, so that being the example of a kind of hopeless look at the future, with a show like The Walking Dead, you know, I've been watching that show for a while now, and I think, you know, it's true what you say. part of the reason that you watch it is to strip everything back down and say, if I didn't have my job, if I didn't have any of these trappings of society, you know, what would be important and what would be your reason for living?
Exactly. Carl, get back in the house. Right? Yeah. I mean, there's a strong parenting theme through the first few seasons. I mean, eventually Carl just kind of breaks out and becomes his own man, right?
Yeah.
In that sense, it's a coming of age story. Just like other stories, like that don't need zombies to, you know, necessarily be the plot engine, right?
Yeah, no. It sort of creates a situation that you can really examine.
Yeah.
A stripped down version of life.
Yeah.
And when I strip everything down in the Passage trilogy, the one thing that really rises up to me is the Lucessi's note about love. And
I'm sorry, wait.
I don't know if I'm saying it right. Lucessi's
Lucchese.
Lucchese, right.
Lucchese.
I'm saying it very wrong.
Yeah, Lucchese. Right. Yes. Love is all there is, and love is pain, and love is taken away.
Yes. And then later, there's a line, and for the life of me, I can't actually remember whose head we're in when it happens, but it's like everything else will fade into the past except for love.
Yeah. All things fall into the past but one, and what that was love. It's part of Fanning's narrative towards the end. All things fell in the past, but one. Yeah.
Is that his very, very last appearance in the book?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
So that to me really struck a chord, and that is, I think, what lies at the real heart of these books, and why they're so powerful, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted the novels to be a demonstration of the human qualities that, as I said, would make us worth the bother. Or make us more than just a species.
Yeah.
Right? And of course, you know, the Fanning narrative is one of somebody who loses that belief.
Mm.
You know, he descends into nihilism, right? As it turns out, the whole problem, you know, the end of the world in this book is caused by a broken heart.
I couldn't believe how much I came to care for Fanning as a character.
I'm glad. I wanted that to happen. Yeah. Right? Very human story, right? Yeah.
When you're able to really bring love to the forefront of every character, like these characters are written with such love, perhaps Fanning especially.
Well, because first person thrusts the reader, you know, the fact that he tells his own story thrusts the reader into a situation of deep, deep, deep intimacy with him, right? And psychologically, you may not know that's what's happening, but that is what is happening.
Yeah.
Right. And for all of his mistakes, they become, or I wanted them to seem this way, and it's for the reader to judge. But I wanted people to be able to see his journey as one that is just a human journey, like the ones many of us take. I mean, some readers were angry. He was like, he's pure evil. And I said, no, he's not. He was born an innocent soul just like you.
Yeah.
Right? Just like you. He was a lovely little baby cooing in the cradle, loved by his parents, and he went to school and he tried to figure out things about himself, and he was very bright, so he ascended into a world that was socially unknown to him, you know, a fancy Eastern university, but where he was admired and appreciated and had friends and fell in love. Right? That's who he is. That's who he is.
And then a little bit later, he did some other things.
Yeah, right. But it's motivated by circumstance. He's not intrinsically a bad person.
No,
I mean, he gets really, really, really screwed. Right? Cosmically screwed. And what would you do if you were as cosmically screwed as Fanning? Don't think for a second that you'd be better.
No.
Don't think that.
No.
You know? And that's what I wanted the reader to... That's the state of mind I wanted to create with that story. There are no villains and there are no heroes, not in life. You know, we are all a collection of contradictions. That's how I define the word personality. You know, like who you are is just, your personality is just a collection of contradictions. Mm-hmm. And if you're gonna make the reader care about your characters and the world they inhabit, you need to be truthful about what people are. Right?
Yeah.
You have to write an honest book, emotionally honest. I think the difference between brisk, merely entertaining commercial fiction and something else, like what I try to write, is that the world seems real, right? And you have to put some dirt on the hero, and you have to throw some sunlight on the villain, because that's who people are. With very few exceptions in human history, nobody is just one thing.
Yeah, well, Gray is another example of that. I wanted to actually talk to you about two characters that didn't show up until City of Mirrors that really came alive for me, and that was, one was Pym and the other was Law.
Yeah.
Were they, you always knew they were coming?
Sure.
Like, they just burst on the scene and such.
Well, each book needed refreshment. You know, each book needed an injection of new important people because, first of all, a lot of time passes, and that's what life does, right? New people come to the fore. And Lore, of course, exists in the second book, and with a sort of accumulating importance in volume two. She's, you know, she's part of the journey to the homeland.
Mm.
But I always knew that, you know, her relationship with Michael was actually a very special one that they had to negotiate. And she's enormously resourceful. She's sort of the girl Michael in a lot of ways. And but she was the fourth aspect of female strength that I put into the book. The female characters are really the primary actors, right? The men, with the exception of Michael, I would say, and Greer, are sort of much more uncertain and are kind of handling the luggage, you know? And
Peter.
Well, yeah, but even he spends a lot of his time in a state of uncertainty, right?
Yeah.
Right? The story is really, the thrust of the story is really generated by the female characters. And what I did was, by design, was to take sort of the traditional characteristics of female strength, right, which is different from male strength. We're oxen, I know that. and apportion them out into four different female characters. Amy being the sort of intuitive spiritual strength that these are just things I've observed in the world. I mean, I have female friends, I got a wife, I got a daughter. Amy, spiritual, intuitive strength, a connection to the world that's somewhat more subtle and supple than men. Sarah is the healer, nurturer, mother, right? Named after Sarah in the Bible, mother of nations, right?
It's a great name.
Yeah, it's a great name. Yeah, that's right. It's the name you're packing, right?
Yeah.
Alicia is raw female warrior strength, right? The kind that a woman would use if somebody in her family was threatened. Right, that's really what she's doing. You know, they say soldiers don't die for their country, they die for the person standing next to them, and that's Alicia, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know that if somebody threatened one of our children, my wife would make every effort, and it would be entirely spontaneous, to tear them to pieces.
She'd go Alicia Blades.
Yeah, yeah. What most women would. I mean, like, it's a deep programming, and there is a kind of strength of endurance that women possess. They're biologically organized. You know, they're made for endurance. Men are made for lifting a heavy object very quickly, right? Whereas women are made for endurance. And, you know, it's childbirth is the classic example of that. And if you've watched a woman have a baby, as I've done twice, like, don't think for a second that we're tougher than women. Okay, forget it. They're vastly tougher. You know, a 20-hour labor and a 2-hour pushing stage? Oh, you know, I could have done that. No way. And then Lore is sensuality.
Right.
Okay. Lore is the raw sensuality of the body. And, you know, we meet her as somebody who just really likes sex. Like, in the beginning, right? She's sort of Michael's demon volcano lover, right? Which is exactly what he needs at that moment of his life to sort of bring him into sort of full manhood, right? He needs somebody to initiate him like that, to go from being, you know, nerdy, clever boy to the man he becomes. And Lore is like, she's really part of that. And that's why she's in the story.
I loved how she handled her heartbreak. It was just so honest. And
Straight up. You broke my heart and I say it once, right?
Yeah. And now we're done.
Yeah. Yeah.
She was really cool.
Yeah. While she's putting a pistol in the back of her jeans. Right? She, you know, decocks the gun, puts it back, say, I'm going to say this once. And she's a woman in her 50s at that time, right? I mean, all the characters have aged. They've caught up to my age, to my phase.
How was that?
Great. I was delighted that it happened. I mean, I knew it was going to happen because of the amount of time necessary for the, I don't know how much spoilering I should do, but the big project of the third book that Michael Letter takes is one that's going to take a couple of decades.
Yeah.
So it's going to propel the story forward a long way into my phase of life. There's a strong thread in the third book of empty nester syndrome, right? And empty nest syndrome is more than just the kids growing up and leaving you, because that's what happens. Caleb grows up and leaves. He starts a family, and Peter and Sarah have to watch their kids. Like, they wave them at the gate. There they go, yeah. Right? But it's also a sort of professional moment, and it's a moment in your marriage. It's, you know, it's that moment of reckoning where you realize you've become, you know, one of the people that runs things. You're at that point, right? You know, Peter's become the president,
yeah.
Right? I am the same age as the president of the United States. It amazes me. But my generation now is like sort of in charge, right? And I'm at sort of the apex of my career in some ways. I'm concluding this big project. You know, there's a it's a moment of conclusion and then wondering what comes next, right? And I was delighted that my characters would reach that phase. I wanted each book to, in a sense, represent a phase of life, right? Childhood, adulthood, then sort of like what's beyond that, that next phase, and where people make a final commitment to some cause, and they have to decide if they're just going to go gentle into that good night or not, right? So again, I was thoroughly delighted that I got to talk about myself in the third book. It's what we all long for as writers.
Well, Justin, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us today. It's been so nice to chat.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
And everyone, Justin's books are available at Booktopia, www.booktopia.com.au.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.